A special thank you to everyone who is tuning in to Lullaby the Fear podcast. If this is your first time and you love the show, then please leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts to become a true Fear Cult ambassador. It supports the show for free and motivates me to research deeper cases. Sweet dreams.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Believe in ghosts?
The first simply disappeared, the other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. This is it. This is the final frontier of the case voted by you, the Fear Cult, as the most requested serial killer examination. Richard Ramirez. If you haven't listened to part one, then go back right now, because I intricately detailed Richard's childhood and his progression to where this episode starts off. And if you immediately start on this episode, it'll be a torch to your system, because there's no transition from his childhood into these crimes. Please do go back and listen to part one. I discuss his brain injuries and the people who influenced his life in a fluid progression, because I love details. All right, I gave you your warning, so proceed with caution. With that being said, welcome to Lullaby. We left off with Richard's crimes at the home of Vincent and Maxine Zazera, which is where I'm going to start the introduction recap for this episode. This is the final conclusion of the evil true crimes of the Night Stalker. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of rape, crimes against children, mental and physical abuse, necrophilia, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. On March 27th, 1985, the killer's heart was beating as if he had just been running, with sweat beading down his forehead. He stalked his way around the side of the ranch-styled house belonging to 64-year-old Vincent and 44-year-old Maxine Zazera, located in Whittier, California. Richard peered through the window and seen Vincent asleep on the couch with the television on. Looking around, he noticed a few of the other lights were left on in the house. As he walked around the house, he found that there was a window for the master bedroom. Inside, he seen Maxine asleep on the bed, and this sexually aroused him. This was perfect. As his adrenaline increased, Richard attempted to break into the residence, but all the doors and windows were locked. With his hands on his waist, he noticed a smaller window up above that would be easier to pry open. He grabbed an aluminum bucket and placed it under the frame. It didn't take much of his strength to open the window and slither a small frame into the Zazera's laundry room. Quietly bending down, Richard removed his shoes so that he could move around silently. Richard made his rounds about the home, taking in everything, noticing what he could steal, where he could hide, and to memorize the layout. He then came to the sleeping body of Vincent Zazera. Pulling the .22 revolver from his waistband, he felt himself lick his lips. Satan would be pleased, he thought. Another infidel for his army of darkness. He stood inches away from Vincent, and above his left ear, he pulled the trigger. The bullet entered through the side of his head and ricocheted inside of his skull. In amazement, Vincent tried to stand up and pull the weapon away from Richard. But soon, Vincent lost all motor control from the gun wound, and he collapsed on the floor. Richard was so entranced by the blood that he nearly forgot about Maxine in the bedroom. Surely she had been awoken by the blast of the gunshot. Richard dashed into the bedroom, pointing the .22 at the screaming woman. He slapped her hard across the face and yelled at her to shut up.
Shut up, bitch, and you don't look at me.
Richard jumped on top of her body and began beating her relentlessly,
bitch,
demanding that she didn't look at him. He then tied her hands together and gagged her.
Stupid fucking bitch.
He began disconnecting the phones, followed by ransacking the entire room. There had to be money or diamonds hidden somewhere in this house. Maxine had begun internally panicking, realizing that she had kept a shotgun underneath the bed. But there was no way she'd be able to get it in her current state. She had to relax. She could hear her husband's gargled breathing. That was an indication that he was dying in the other room. With every ounce of her strength she could muster, she wrangled out of her restraints. Maxine silently rolled off the bed and retrieved the shotgun. Aiming at the intruder who was distracted, she promptly pulled the trigger. The gun was empty. Not even a week prior, her husband Vincent had removed the bullets because their grandchildren had been visiting. The blood instantly drained from her body, and Richard reached for his own gun.
Bitch!
With no hesitation, he shot Maxine 3 times. She fell to her knees. Richard began kicking her body and cursing at her in a full rage.
You think that you overpower the Night Stalker? I'm a soldier, Satan! There's nothing you can do to stop me.
Once Maxine could barely move, Richard stormed out of the room. He returned with a 10-inch long kitchen knife and proceeded to throw her weak body onto the bed. He lifted her purple nightie. Taking the blade, he attempted to cut her heart out from underneath her left breast. He wasn't able to slice through her rib cage and left an inverted cross underneath her breast. How dare she fight back and try to kill him? He was Satan's messenger, and he was going to take every part of her soul, as a reminder that nobody could hurt him while Lucifer was watching over. Richard then cut the back of her eyelids and dug his fingers deep behind the back of her sockets to remove her eyes. She couldn't look at him now. Taking the eyeballs, he placed them in a jewelry box and stashed them in a pillowcase of valuables. He watched her body wreathe in shock. She wasn't going anywhere, and he laughed out loud. Taking the knife in amusement, he stabbed her 8 times in the chest, 2 in her pubic area, and multiple stabs to her throat. Once he stopped, he attempted to rape her corpse, but he was too full of adrenaline to continue anymore for the night. The Night Stalker did 1 more sweep of the house and left as if nothing had happened. 2 weeks after the attack, Richard walked from his room at the Cecil Hotel down to the Cameo Theater on Broadway. The theater would play porno films 24 hours a day, which Richard frequently enjoyed. There were times when Richard was watching films and he would see women with pentagrams drawn on their bodies, which excited him beyond belief and gave him ideas. This is the final conclusion of the evil true crimes of the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez. In the silent evening of May 14th in Monterey Park, when the killer was searching for his next thrill, he lurked in the shadows and found a random house. It felt good to him. This was the one. The house belonged to 66-year-old Bill Doy and his 56-year-old disabled wife Lillian. Lillian had been recovering from a stroke and was struggling with verbal communication. She was also unable to walk and was bound to a wheelchair. Richard had entered the building by cutting the screen out of the bathroom window. He climbed in. He appeared like a ghost in the bedroom where Lillian Doy had been sleeping. He took notice of her wheelchair and laughed to himself. Checking the other rooms, he noticed that the couple did not sleep in the same room. He then found Bill. Richard cocked his gun, and the sound woke Bill instantly. He reached over and grabbed his 9mm from the nightstand, but Richard shot first. The bullet entered Bill's upper lip and lodged in the back of his throat. The man's body fell off the bed, and when Richard tried to shoot Bill again, his gun jammed. He then proceeded to physically beat the man unconscious. Taking Bill's 9mm, he strode back into Lillian's room. She had been mumbling incoherently after waking to the sound of the gunshot. For the first time, Richard took out a pair of thumb cuffs that were utilized in the military in the Vietnam War, something he learned from his cousin Mike. He secured Lillian's thumbs into the cuffs and began ransacking the house for valuables and cutting the phone lines. Richard heard Bill begin to wake up, and he then went back into the room and beat him unconscious another time. This sexually charged Richard beyond belief. He then ran back into the bedroom and violently raped Lillian. Once he was done, he kissed her and left without taking the thumb cuffs off. Bill then regained consciousness 1 more time and slinked over to the phone and called 911.
911, what's your emergency?
He passed out during his first attempt, but he was able to call again soon after with all the strength that he had. He was the only one who could save his wife. The firefighters, EMS, and police all arrived. Bill Doy was rushed to the hospital, and the officers tried to question Lillian. The forensics team collected the thumb cuffs and discovered an Avia shoe print, size 11 and a half, outside of the residence. 66-year-old Bill Doy died of his injuries at 5:29 a.m. 15 days after the attack of Bill and Lillian Doy, Richard struck again, this time on May 29th, in Monrovia in North Atla Vista. The picket-fenced home sat underneath the Sierra Madre Mountains, and Richard again had chosen this house at random. It was nearing midnight when he reached the front door, which was unlocked. Richard wandered around and realized that he had chosen the wrong home. The house was filled with nothing of value. It was clear that the residents were not well off. Walking into a bedroom, he seen an elderly, invalid woman, 81-year-old Florence Nettie Lang. Nettie shared a home with her older sister, Mabel Bell, whose friends called her Maybell. Richard became annoyed. There were no young women here. He went into the kitchen to find a knife to kill them, but only found a hammer. This will have to do, he thought. Creeping back into the bedroom of Nettie Lang, he began swinging the hammer repeatedly, striking her in the skull. He then ripped the alarm clock out of the wall and used the cord to tie her hands behind her back. The clock stopped at 12:06 a.m. On the way out of the room, he stepped on the clock and left a blood print of his Avia shoe, size 11 and a half. Back in Maybell's room, he swung the hammer into her head. The elderly woman woke up screaming, and Richard began shouting at her, asking where all the money was. She cried out that she was poor and she didn't have anything for him. This angered Richard, and he hit her in the head again, sending brain matter across the room. The poor woman cried, asking who he was and why he was doing this to her. Richard only laughed. Richard duct-taped her hands. He then ripped the bedside clock from the wall outlet, which frayed the ends of the wires. This then gave him a sadistic idea. He plugged the cord back into the wall and began electrocuting Maybell. He felt the power of Satan flowing through his veins, and he was proud of his actions. Richard was sexually charged. He strode back into Nettie Lang's room and raped her. After, he used Maybell's red lipstick and drew a pentagram on the back of her thigh and then on the wall above her head. He also drew a pentagram on the wall in Nettie's room. He put the lipstick down and went back into the kitchen and drank a Coke. He urinated in the toilet and left. At that time, both women survived the attack, but were not discovered until 3 days later. Maybell died later due to her injuries, and Nettie fell into a comatose state, but survived.
I was cruising around Burbank, listening to the greats on my headset. Billy Idol, AC/DC, Judas Priest. The only way they play is loud. Hanging my arm out the window, I let my headset rest back as the breeze hit my face. This is the fucking life. It was time again. My energy was overwhelming. I found a good location that was in a good area to burglarize. The houses almost begged to be broken into. There were not too many streetlights, and many of the houses had trees in the yards that shielded their windows. Everything I looked for. Under the moonlight, I felt like a vampire accepting the task from the unholy father. It was close to 4 a.m. when I entered the home of 42-year-old Carol Kyle. I didn't know her personally or anything. I usually use this little pen light when I enter a house. It's easy to turn off if I hear a sound, and great if I'm handling a gun at the same time. At this point I was. The excitement that builds inside my core makes me want to charge into rooms, scaring the shit out of people. It's really good if they're passed out in a deep sleep. I made sure the house was clear and peeled into the rooms. Then I found the master bedroom with a lone woman. I'm going to fucking enjoy this. Wake up, you bitch! And don't you fucking scream or I'll kill you. Don't make a fucking sound, understand?
I understand. Yes, I understand.
Who else is in the house?
My son.
Where is he?
He's in his room. He's sleeping. He won't bother you. What do you want? Just tell me what you want.
I'll shoot you in the face if you move. Don't you fucking move. Don't you fucking look at me. Don't move. Don't look at me. What the hell is wrong with you?
I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
You need to fucking listen to me.
I'm sorry.
Do you have any guns in the house?
No. No, there are no guns in this house.
Don't you fucking lie to me. You'll fucking regret it.
I am not lying to you.
So help you if I find any.
You won't, you won't. There are no guns in this house.
I yanked her out of the bed and demanded her to show me to her kid's room. The woman had to have been scared, although she held it in very well. Little did I know, Carol Kyle was a trained nurse and had taken many courses on how to remain calm under pressure. She had even participated in class to deal with unstable patients. As we entered her son's room, I dropped Carol to the floor, threatening to kill her if she tried to run. I'll shoot you in the face if you move.
I won't move.
I honestly lost all trust in victims since one woman pulled a shotgun on me. Thanks, Satan, for watching over me. The stupid bitch didn't have it loaded. Upon seeing the small form of a child in bed, I charged onto the sleeping 11-year-old boy and pointed the gun in his face. Don't you fucking move!
Don't you fucking touch him! Stay away from him! You can have whatever you want, but you don't fucking touch my son!
The woman launched herself between me and the kid. Not too much of a surprise. It is his mother. Just a hurdle. She pleaded with me, like a peasant. And then she fucking looked at me. Don't fucking look at me. What the hell is wrong with you? You need to fucking listen to me.
Just take whatever you want and go.
I gripped her arm so tight and locked her into one of the handcuffs. And then locked her son in the other. Taking my gun, I ushered them down the hallway and pushed them to the floor inside the closet. You don't have any guns in the house, do you?
No.
If you lie to me, and if I find any, you will regret it.
I'm not lying to you.
The woman just shook her head, and her son looked terrified. Fuck, it felt amazing. I glared at the two once over and slammed the closet door. There was a rush of excitement I always craved. That feeling of complete control. Satan be with me. I used my energy and ransacked the shit out of the house, searching for valuables. I'm glad the police are the ones who have to deal with my mess and not me. The blood isn't so bad. I could probably do it for them if they didn't arrest me. I couldn't find any. I marched back to the closet and swung that door open. The two jumped. I pulled Carol out and slammed the door, leaving her son behind it. He was a brave kid. He listened. Something he picked up from his mother. Where's all your jewelry? Money? Diamonds? Anything?
You can have whatever you want. Just don't hurt my children, please.
Children? I thought you said you only had a son.
My son is the only one in the house. My daughter's having a sleepover at a friend's house. She won't be back until morning.
Maybe I'll just have to wait until morning. I felt her presence stiffen up at the mention of her daughter. I then wanted to make her remember who was in control. Stop! Don't move! Raise both your hands up in the air and spread your fingers.
I was just going to get you the jewelry.
Don't pick anything up. Don't do anything unless I fucking give you a command to. She pulled out this tiny gold necklace with a diamond on the end of it. I was waiting for her to get more, but she just stood there with her eyes down. Where are all the other things? The rings, necklaces, money. Where is it all?
That's all I can give you. That's the only thing I have. My husband died 6 years ago, and he left this house for me and my children. What you're holding is my wedding ring. I got made into a necklace. So unless you can accept, that's everything I have to offer you for my family's life. You're gonna leave very disappointed. And I'm sorry, I can't offer you anything else. I've done everything you want.
You'll be fine. Just do what I say and you both will survive. I could feel deep down that she knew what was going to happen next. But for her life, all she could do was submit. I towered over her. And just like that, Satan took over.
It was revealed later in court that Richard was unable to achieve an erection and ended up slamming his body into her tailbone, causing immense pain. Carol was scared that he would have killed her out of embarrassment, but he didn't. When the police arrived, Carol detailed the events and completed a composite sketch with an artist. It didn't resemble the one that Maria Hernandez had created. Sometime in early June of 1985, Richard had attempted to break into the home of John Rodriguez, an LA sheriff's deputy. He tried to pry open the window, and then he realized it was going to take more leverage. Sticking a screwdriver in the painted seams, he slammed it open. He then heard the sound of a woman asking her husband if she had just opened the window. Richard ran back to his stolen car and sped off. John Rodriguez called the police, and he also called lead homicide detective Gil Carrero, informing him that he had the Avia shoe print. Many of the officers around California believed that there was more than one serial killer. Detective Gil Carrero thought opposite. This was the moment that solidified to him that there was truly one serial killer. Soon after, Detective Frank Salerno and Gil Carrero became official partners with the goal of catching the psychopath. That night in June, when Richard had failed to break into the home of John Rodriguez, he was left in a pent-up state. He tried to abduct a young girl in Eagle Rock, but she screamed and Richard had to run off. The girl called the police, giving a description of the tall man, with shaggy black hair, Mexican ethnicity, driving a blue Toyota. Back in his car, he was speeding down the freeway and ran a red light. Officer John Stavros pulled him over. The officer asked Richard to hand over his license and registration. Richard explained that he did not have it, which was true. This wasn't even his vehicle. The officer told Richard to get out of the car and put his hands on the hood. He then searched him, but found nothing. The officer asked him his name so that he could call it in and confirm with headquarters that everything was all right. If so, he was going to let him go with only a ticket. As the officer was completing his paperwork, he heard over the radio a description of the suspect who had just tried to abduct the young girl. The officer didn't realize that he had in his hands the man himself, driving the exact same blue Toyota. Richard lifted his head and looked over at the officer who was by his motorcycle. He just heard everything over the radio. When the officer came back over, he chuckled and asked, "Hey, you're not that guy killing people in their homes, are you?" Richard laughed and said, "No way, man. When are you guys gonna catch that fucker?" The officer assured him that the police were going to catch him, and soon. He went back to his motorbike to take a note. The officer didn't notice Richard drawing a pentagram on the hood of the car, which after he took off running as fast as his legs could carry him. Okay, I gotta say it. Could you imagine being that cop and having to live that down? Oh my God, as someone who has anxiety, that moment would live with me forever. I wouldn't be able to handle that. So the officer searches this blue Toyota and the hood is covered in handprints. And then he finds this black leather wallet with a dentist appointment card in it with an address and a phone book. Because I'm not focusing really on the investigation, because that's an entire fucking episode on its own, which is unbelievably fascinating, but I'm not doing that. I'm focusing on the psychology of Richard Ramirez. So later in the timeline, the homicide investigators, they use this evidence to track down the dentist who had an appointment with the suspect. And Richard had made an appointment because his teeth had rotted so bad and they've grown abscesses underneath them in the gums that they caused him pain and he had to get them fixed. The appointment was for July 3rd. So at that time, officers planted cops in the dental office, but he never showed up. so nothing came of it. And since this hasn't happened yet, because this happens on July 3rd, and currently in the story we are in June, just remember this information for later, because this is kind of a background thing that's happening as Richard's committing all these crimes. Because the two homicide detectives that are leading this case, Frank Salerno and Gil Carrillo, like, they are tracking this guy as best as they can, and the departments aren't wanting to help anybody, and they're doing everything that they can in their power to track him down. And they've got the 22 bullet, and they've got the Avia shoe print, and I will talk more about that later. Those officers, they're so good. I'm kind of going off here a little bit, but there's a documentary on Netflix called The Night Stalker, and it fully goes into the investigation. So I highly recommend that you watch that, because I'm not focusing on the investigation. I'm focusing on the progression of Richard himself. So yeah, watch. Oh, you know what? Maybe I'll just recommend that as our movie at the end. No, I'm recommending it now. Netflix, The Night Stalker. Watch it. Boom. Moving on. On June 27th, Richard broke into the home of 28-year-old Patty Elaine Higgins. He slit her throat, killing her instantly. He didn't strike again until July 2nd, where he broke into the Arcadia home of 75-year-old Mary Louise Cannon. He crawled through the window after removing the screen, and he found the sleeping woman on her bed. Again, no young woman at the house, and it infuriated him. Richard grabbed a large base lamp, and he hit Mary over the head. When she woke up screaming, he started to punch her, sending her into a daze. He then found a 10-inch knife and repeatedly stabbed Mary in the neck, killing her instantly. He ransacked the home and left. When the police arrived the next day, they searched the home and found the shoe print on the new rug in the house. It was positively identified as an Avia size 11.5 shoe. When detectives Frank Salerno and Gil Carrillo received this information, they called a meeting, finally resulting in the police believing that these crimes were all carried out by the same criminal. On July 5th, 1985, 16-year-old Whitney Bennett had just arrived home around 1 a.m. from a party with her friends. Fearing that she was going to be in trouble because she was out past curfew, she quietly entered her home. After washing up, she crawled into bed and went to sleep. Both her parents had been fast asleep in their rooms. Richard had chosen this home at random. Using his penlight, he crept around the house, and he made his way into Whitney's bedroom. He watched her sleep for a while. Then, he checked the other rooms to make sure that the coast was clear. His plan was to rape and kill her. When he discovered the parents in their room, he decided he had to change his plans. He couldn't rape her, no matter how aroused he got. She would scream, and both her parents would wake up in the process. Murder would have to do. He then went outside and found a tire iron. He came back in and beat 16-year-old Whitney Bennett. The room was dripping with blood, and Richard recalled the difference between killing with a knife and a tire iron, saying, quote, "Killing with a knife is very personal. You are actually holding it as it goes in. And when death comes, you can feel the victim dying through the knife. It's like sex." Richard jumped onto her back and began choking her with the cord. But then electrical sparks began flying in the air and he stopped. Richard believed it was God sending him a sign that he was protecting her. This scared him and he left immediately. At 5:45 a.m., Whitney woke up screaming, having no recollection of what had happened to her. Her parents ran into the room, almost falling over at the sight of the blood. They called the police. Detective Gil Carrillo said, quote, "It was one of the bloodiest crime scenes I'd ever been at." Whitney Bennett survived, and she had received over 450 stitches to her injuries. This will be the only victim that Richard will later express remorse for hurting. On July 7th, Richard attacked two separate women in Monterey Park. First was 61-year-old Joyce Lucille Nielsen. He left two distinct shoe prints on the location outside of the window that he entered. Richard beat the woman and stomped on her face. He left an imprint of an Avia shoe on her face. He left after he stole the money and jewelry. Right after, he drove to Hollywood Oak Drive, to the home of 63-year-old Sophie Dickman. He unlocked the door using the doggy door and stretched his arm up. When Richard found her room, he ran right over to her, immediately waking her up in the process. She knew that this was the Valley Intruder, aka the Night Stalker. At this moment in time, the Night Stalker was not a name used by the media. Richard forced Sophie to show him where all of her valuables were. Once she informed him that he had everything he could take, Richard bound her and attempted to rape her two separate times, but he couldn't get an erection. Getting frustrated, he zipped up his pants. He grabbed the stolen goods and left. Sophie Dickman survived and called the police. Break time, because Richard is on a horrific bender and Ashley Lana needs time to just chill the fuck out, because expressing all these crimes is a little hard on my psyche, alright? Let's psychologically break this fruitcake down. Does Richard have antisocial personality disorder? Psychologists say, yes, he does. News bulletin, we're all shocked. Let's look at the 7 symptom criteria for our favorite term at Lullaby. According to psychology, there are only 3 needed in order for a doctor to diagnose a person with antisocial personality disorder. And Richard has all 7. Pathological lying, lack of remorse, unlawful behaviors, aggression, impulsivity, disregard for the safety of others, and irresponsibility. Breaking them down. Pathological lying. Richard would lie to his family about committing the crimes, and he didn't want to hurt his family's reputation. And he would later tell his pen pal girlfriends that he was innocent. And they would say, oh, Richie, I believe you. Please make love to me in my coffin, because that's all I want in life and I have no goals. I shit you not, that's actually one of the proposals that he got from a woman in prison. The next one, lack of remorse. He never took responsibility for his crimes, at least not consistently. Growing up, he couldn't justify his sadistic need to associate sex and violence, and he knew it wasn't part of his Christian beliefs, so he turned to Satan to justify it. And Richard admits to this many times. And there is one person that he feels remorse for, but I'll get to that in just a second. But let me continue. Unlawful behaviors. And I think that one's pretty obvious. Aggression. He admitted to having a built-up rage that was mixed with sexual lust for murder, and that's why he had to feed it, or he would explode. He said this. And he had a very short temper, which you could clearly see in his anger towards his victims. And during his trial, he was an absolute menace. Impulsivity. His disorganized crimes were erratic and reckless, which leads us to the next one. Disregard for safety of others. He killed people. Next one. Irresponsibility. He physically let himself go, and he gave himself dragon breath, pretty much. And he skipped school, and he started doing heavy drugs, and his life snowballed downhill from there. That's 7 out of 7, top of the class, Richard, gold fucking star to you. But let's really pick him apart here, because we don't like him. He kills people. The key symptoms of psychopathy. Now, these can be determined with the help of the Hare Psychopathy Checklist, or more commonly known as the PCLR. And it was created by a Canadian psychologist, Robert Hare, in the 1990s. The PCLR is a diagnostic tool to rate a person's psychopathic and/or antisocial personality tendencies. A score of 30 or higher corresponds with a psychopath. It's important to note that the PCLR is not used in isolation to perform a diagnosis. It's rather used in combination with a semi-structured interview and a review of the client's file history records, okay? This is to compensate for the fact that psychopaths are great at lying. The psychopathy checklist is separated into 2 domains. There's factor 1 and factor 2. Let's start Richard off by going through factor 1. Factor 1 involves effective interpersonality functioning as follows. Starting with superficial charm. I mean, the guy had dozens of groupies from a single mugshot. He had groupies before the trial started. And even after he was convicted, women wanted him so bad, he didn't even need to ask for it. Oh, and don't you worry, fear called. In the next off book, I break down hebristophilia, which is when people fall in love with serial killers. It's really exciting. And many people who talked to Richard said that he was very charismatic. The next one, grandiose sense of worth. The guy thought he was a demon for Satan's army, for fuck's sakes, and not metaphorically. Pathological lying and manipulation. Again, he lied about being innocent. Prone to boredom and need for constant stimulation. He killed people for sexual gratification and he was always drugged out. Next, shallow effect. Go watch interviews with Richard Ramirez. Whenever he talks about his crimes, he shows little emotion or you can see this smug pride in his micro expressions. Lack of empathy. In court, he would laugh during survivor or witness testimonies, and Richard couldn't relate to the pain he caused others. Poor behavioral control. As said before, he grew up to become a problem child. He started abusing drugs and breaking and entering and killing people. Comes full circle, really. Lack of remorse of guilt. This one's interesting because, yes, he showed lack of remorse for his crimes, except one. And lead homicide detective Gil Carrillo explained in an interview that Richard asked him to apologize to a 16-year-old survivor, which I can only assume was Whitney Bennett, the girl who he beat with a tire iron. Why did he show remorse? Now, I'm not a psychologist, and I can't give a definitive answer, but I do have my own personal armchair detective theory. You ready for this? Stay with me. While Richard was strangling Whitney with the electrical cables, it began sparking, and he recalled thinking that it was a sign from God, who, as we all know, is Satan's arch nemesis. So out of fear, he stopped and he left, and Whitney survived. I think that he felt remorse because he took it as a sign from God that he wasn't supposed to attack Whitney, and therefore he felt bad because maybe he didn't see the signs from his leader telling him, don't do this. That's just a thought. The last one for factor one is parasitic lifestyle, which Richard didn't have. He did everything on his own. Well, he did steal other people's money and stuff, but I'm not splitting hairs. Moving on to factor two domain, and these are traits that are a measure of chronic instability and antisocial lifestyle. Promiscuous behavior, and that one's obvious. He raped and committed necrophilia. The dude had a problem. Juvenile delinquency, he started breaking and entering as early as 12 years old. Lack of realistic long-term goals. Richard didn't have any goals, at least any realistic ones. He pretty much just wanted to rape and control women and live this big luxurious life because of his stolen riches and sit next to Satan and have beers on Friday nights when he died. He didn't have a job, and nor did he want one. Early behavioral problems. Once he suffered his second head injury and started having seizures, he was starting to spiral. And then once his cousin Mike murdered his wife, it all just went off the deep end and his crimes elevated. Impulsivity. Richard's crimes were always random and unorganized. Irresponsibility. Yes, he was very irresponsible. He killed people. And criminal versatility. Richard was very versatile. He would change his MO constantly, which made it difficult for law enforcement to come to terms with the concept that it was only one man. And as I mentioned earlier in the episode, police were on a manhunt, and only two homicide detectives were convinced early on that it was one man, Detective Frank Salerno and Detective Gil Carrillo. And these two, they got shit done. Like Frank Salerno, if you don't know who he is, this guy was the one who caught the Hillside Stranglers. And he did it by finding a minute piece of thread in an eye socket of a dude. Like, that's guards for, like, you don't fuck with that guy. And then Gil, he was the new kid on the block with the other detectives, and they thought he was foolish to believe that it was only one person committing these crimes. But they didn't realize that Gil had an arsenal of education, and when he teamed up with Frank Salerno, Richard Ramirez was done. He was fucked. There was no way he was getting out of that one. Now, I'm not focusing heavily on the investigation, as I said before, because many people already know the details, but as I said, if you want to watch an awesome documentary on the investigation, it's called The Night Stalker, The Hunt for a Serial Killer, and it's on Netflix. In summary, Richard scored 30, which resulted in psychiatrists and psychologists labeling him as a primary psychopath. Richard would not have stopped killing unless he was captured. Richard Ramirez was a disorganized thrill control killer, which made him vicious and extremely deadly. And despite his nickname, he didn't actually stalk his victims for days. It was always random. He would prowl in the night, and he would kill for lust, and it's something that he idolized Jack the Ripper over, and he said early on that he was fascinated by Jack the Ripper around the age of 12, which is funny, the age when his cousin Mike shot his wife, and he said that his cousin Mike had no influence on him. Bullshit! I'm hyper. I'm sorry. Bear with me. I'm really passionate over this shit, all right? I love investigating. Ugh. So the detectives, They didn't catch him on July 3rd for his dental appointment. As I said before, they didn't catch him. So they had an alleged name to go off of from the appointment, which was Richard Mena. And the police ran this name through every database they could, but got nothing. And they knew all the murders were committed by the same man, described the same way by all the victims. Tall, Mexican descent, shaggy black hair, bad teeth, horrible breath, and dark eyes. And they also knew that he wore a size 11.5 Avia sneaker. At this point, Richard is on a murder spree, and he is reading the papers that detail his crimes and relishing in it. Before, Richard kind of felt as though he was killing people, but it wasn't this media frenzy. And after reading how scared everyone was, he wanted more attention, because he didn't realize that he had the attention. He was never popular, so he loved this. So what does Richard do? He decides to make his next crimes more violent than ever, just to scare people. He goes to a knife shop and buys a machete, and he plans to decapitate his next victims and leave the heads on the front lawn for the police and media and Paperboy Billy to see the next day. Let's continue. On the night of July 20th, 1985, the killer would attack two more homes on the same night. Richard parked his car outside of the Glendale home of 68-year-old Max Needling and his 66-year-old wife, Leela. He broke into their bedroom wielding a machete and began swinging the blade at Max's neck, hoping it would slice it off just like in the movies. But it didn't. The blade wasn't sharp enough. When Max fell back, Richard started swinging at Leela, and he missed. To his disappointment, he didn't kill them the way he wanted to. So then he took out his .22 and shot them both to death. Richard was carrying a police scanner so he could hear everything that the reports were detailing. He then heard shots fired over the scanner. Rushing to his stolen Toyota, he casually drove away as the police cruiser was going by. He got away again, but he wasn't done. Richard said that he always thought the way he was going to go down was while he was attacking his victims in their home. He envisioned a freeway getaway chase where the guns rang out through the night and hit the back of his stolen car. To prepare for this, Richard always purchased boxes of books from the local Goodwill and kept them on his back window for protection. Richard drove north to Sun Valley, Los Angeles. He broke into the home of China Rong and some kid Kovanaugh and their 8-year-old son and 2-year-old daughter. Richard put the barrel of the .22 straight to China Rong's head and killed him instantly. He then raped some kid in front of the body of her husband. Right after, he forced her to listen to him sodomize their son with a bottle of baby oil. Once he finished, he ransacked the house and then raped some kid again. He climaxed and then left the home, leaving the mother and her children alive. On August 6th, Richard attacked 38-year-old Chris and 27-year-old Virginia Peterson, who were in their home with their 5-year-old daughter. Richard entered their bedroom, and Virginia bravely yelled at the intruder, demanding that he leave their home at once. Richard shot her husband, Chris, in the head. Miraculously, he survived. Chris jumped off the bed and charged Richard, who fired 2 more rounds and then fled the home. Everyone survived the attack, and both victims were able to provide a detailed description of their assailant. When the police arrived, the media did as well, and reporters began begging Detectives Frank Salerno and Gil Perillo for any statements on the Night Stalker. Officers had a policy of not speaking to the press during any ongoing investigations. Frank Salerno decided that since they were hounded by reporters, he was going to release a statement stating that the attacker had shown his true colors, indicating that he was a coward. When Richard read the headline in this dingy hotel apartment, he was offended. He thought that what he was doing was brave, breaking into random homes and committing horrific crimes, not knowing what was going to happen. Satan would be proud, and he would have a seat for him in hell. Two nights later, Richard broke into the home of 35-year-old Elias Abowath in Diamond Bar, where he lived with his wife, 27-year-old Sakina. The couple had 2 sons, a 3-year-old and a 10-week-old at the time. Richard was able to get in through the sliding glass door and enter the living room. Scoping the area, he found the room of Elias, Sakina, and their 10-week-old, sleeping next to the bed in his crib. Casually striding up to the side of the bed where Elias sleep, Richard pulled out his .25 automatic and pulled the trigger, killing him instantly. Sakina woke up terrified, not knowing what was truly happening.
Shut up, bitch, and stop moving, or I'll murder everyone in this house.
She was terrified, but she did what she was told. The man dressed in black began ripping through her belongings, ransacking the room. Grabbing a shirt, he wrapped it around her head so that she could no longer see. He also started forcing a part of the shirt into her mouth to stop her from screaming. Sakina bit down on the cloth to stop it from being shoved further down her throat. Richard then slapped her across the face multiple times.
Don't fucking resist this, or I'll shoot you in the skull.
As per his routine, he started ransacking the home and disconnecting the phone lines. Sakina was lying and waiting for him to come back. Her hot tears began soaking the shirt around her eyes as her thoughts began churning. Was he going to kill them? Would he take what he wanted and just leave? Then, she started listening for the sound of her husband, but she heard nothing. The 10-week-old in the crib lying next to her was awake from all the commotion of the intruder. Richard then stormed back into the bedroom, pulling Sakina's blindfold off and taking the gag out of her mouth.
Where's all the money, you stupid bitch? You better think twice before lying to the son of Satan.
The profuse bleeding from Sakina's mouth had caused her to incoherently mumble a response back to Richard. She glanced towards the closet.
In the back room.
Use your fucking words.
There's a on the floor. There's a healing on the floor. There's a bag inside the place. Please look.
He looked over to where she pointed, and he didn't understand what she said. He then slapped her again.
Just fucking answer me.
In the closet, on the floor. Go in there and look on the floor in the bag in the corner. If you just look.
Giving her one final punch to the face, he started rummaging through the suitcases and bags in the closet. Not being able to find what Sakina was referring to, he started beating her again.
Don't look at me! Do you think this is a fucking game?
Closet! On the floor! Stop! Hurting me, please.
Then stop making this difficult.
Richard finally found the valuables that he was looking for, and even more than he imagined, including bars of gold, rings, and other golden jewelry. He then slowly turned back to her, his eyes dead and black, with pure demonic lust and hatred.
You utter one fucking scream and I'll fucking kill you.
I swear to God, I won't scream. I won't move.
No. You swear to Satan, you won't.
I swear to Satan, I won't.
Louder!
I swear on Satan, I won't move or scream.
Richard felt a sense of power grow throughout his body as he stood towering over the woman. He grabbed her by the hair and dragged her into the neighboring bedroom. He forced her to perform oral sex, and then he beat her and sodomized her. Sakina prayed that if she cooperated, then he would keep his word and not kill her family. Sakina believed that her husband Elias was still alive. Soon it was over, and the man in black stopped. She then heard her 3-year-old start crying from the other bedroom.
Go shut up that kid before he pisses me off. Go!
Completely naked, with her arms wrapped behind her back, she ran to her child and was able to lull him back to sleep.
Don't cry, please don't cry. Please stop crying. Please don't cry.
From the doorway, he watched the two with a sadistic lust-filled tension, exciting him again. Richard tore Sakina away from her now sleeping child, and he raped her again, and even went as far as forced drinking her breast milk in the process. She knew it would be over soon, but she had to follow his instructions. It was the power that he craved, and she knew this, and she was the only one keeping her family alive. The man was relentless, and her cries were pleading. Hearing a noise, Richard stopped and shot his head towards the doorway of the bedroom. It slammed open. It was Sakina's 3-year-old son, and he was crying, exclaiming that his father would not wake up. Richard then grabbed the boy and tied him to the bed. He then went back to Sakina and continued to abuse her. After, he then dragged her back into another bedroom, where she seen her husband, not moving, covered in blood. After searching for valuables a little longer, Richard returned to Sakina and raped her for a third time in front of her dead husband. She assumed he was still alive. When her attacker finished, she pleaded with him to spare her husband and her family's lives.
Please don't hurt my family. My husband's a good man. Don't kill him, please. He would never do anything to hurt anyone. Please, I swear to God.
Swear to Satan, bitch.
I swear to Satan, I swear. Just please let my family go.
Richard admitted to feeling guilt for a moment over lying to this woman, but it faded quickly. Richard then tied Sakina in the room with her son and left, slamming the door and entering his car. When she was sure that the man was gone, she got herself and her son free. Her son then went over to his father, Elias, and tried to wake him up. When the police arrived, they declared 35-year-old Elias Abowath dead. When the press released media on the attack, the former Valley intruder was given the official title of the Night Stalker. The public outcry for the capture of the Night Stalker was all the state of California prayed for. Firearms, guard dogs, home security systems, window bars, and safety precautions were at an all-time high. Richard adored the press that he got, seeing detectives Frank Salerno, the famous detective who caught the Hillside Stranglers, being the officer that was fired up about him on the case. He explained that he wasn't going to stop killing unless he died or went to prison. Richard then went to San Francisco because Los Angeles was starting to get hot. Even the fences at the Greyhound bus terminal began eyeing Richard down suspiciously. He matched the description given by the police perfectly. Richard's one-time fence by the name of Jesse Perez had recognized the media descriptions and composites that resembled the man who he had business with once, named Rick. Scared for his own safety, he asked his daughter Pauline to contact the LAPD for him. The reward money was $10,000, and he had tips for the cops. Meanwhile, newly in San Francisco, Richard had checked into the new motel at the Bristol on Mason Street. The new scenery was good for him, he thought. New victims, new thrills. The stalker decided to roam the streets. He then seen a small, beautiful Asian woman who he knew he could easily overpower with his stature. Following her into a quiet apartment, he snuck up behind her and simply beat her until she stopped moving. He then fled. He didn't care if she lived or died, he just wanted an energy boost. Later that same night, on August 18, 1985, Richard broke into the home of 66-year-old Peter and his 62-year-old wife, Barbara Pan. He entered the home by removing the screen from the window and climbing in. Richard slinked up the stairs with his new .25 automatic. He shot Peter in the right temple, killing him instantly. He then beat and raped Barbara and shot her in the head for resisting him. After, he ransacked the house, and using a tube of lipstick, he wrote "Jack the Knife" on the bedroom wall, accompanied by a pentagram, an homage to his idol Jack the Ripper and his lord Lucifer. He left, and only Barbara survived the night. Now things are heating up with the investigation. Detectives Frank Salerno and Gil Carrillo, they heard the news about the Pan murders in San Francisco, and everything seemed to fall in line with their LA Night Stalker case. So they call the San Francisco police and ask about the case, and then they inquire if the bullets found at the Pan residence had a red ring around the primer of the casing. And they did, which connected the .25 automatic at the LA crime scenes with this case. Well, what happens next is undeniably worthy of the facepalm of the decade award, if there were one. After the Pan murder, the mayor of San Francisco at the time, Dianne Feinstein, she held a press conference, okay, in 1985, and the purpose was to calm the citizens down. And she's like, Look, there's no need to worry. The police have vital evidence that link the San Francisco murder to the LA Night Stalker cases. The connecting evidence found at the crime scenes are the same. It's a size 11 and a half ABS shoe print and a 25 automatic gun that leaves red circles around the bullets. So feel confident, everyone. We haven't caught him, but I just told the entire world that we're on to him and told everyone the clues he's leaving behind, because, you know, he's not going to change what he's doing. Yeah, sorry, I'm judging here. I'm so sorry. I don't like judging people. I'm sorry. Okay. And of course, when Richard picks up the newspaper with all this information about the concept of the Night Stalker and all this evidence they have on him, up until this point, he believed that he was completely undetected because he knew that the police districts didn't want to cooperate together. And that's what he learned from the gangs growing up. So when he reads the San Francisco mayor's quote, he thinks, I have Avia size 11 and a half sneakers. And prior to this press conference, the only people who knew about the shoes were the police investigators and obviously Richard because he wore them, but he didn't think that they were finding them at the crimes. And the police departments were pissed because now if the killer paid attention to the media, which he did, then now he's gonna know to dump the sneakers that were pointing him to the crimes. And that's exactly what Richard did. He walked right to the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco and tossed his Avia sneakers into the bay. And then Richard eventually returns home to Los Angeles soon after. And he stayed away from downtown because the reward for his capture now was enough to make even the most trustworthy people turn him in. And then he rented a room in Chinatown, and he bought all the newspapers that described his crimes, and he was starting to keep notes. He absolutely loved it. He loved the nickname the Night Stalker. He thought it was rad. He thought it was metal. He thought that he was the bee's knees for Satan's army. And he was right not to trust anyone, because in LA, as I mentioned before, his one-time fence, Jesse Perez, he had gotten his daughter Pauline to go to the police. And now she's talking to the police over at his house, because he was given full protection from the sheriff's department and had all this information about this Rick. And Jesse explained that this burglar from El Paso named Rick completely matched the composites of the Night Stalker, also known as Rick. And Rick bragged about killing a couple in Monterey Park back in May. And Jesse went to tell the police that Rick got arrested back in December of 1984 for stealing a car and crashing it into a bus terminal. So this means there's a criminal record somewhere that they have to find. Back in San Francisco, the police reported to the public of what items were stolen from the Pan residence with photographs, hoping that whoever the Night Stalker sold them to would come forward with an identification. And a woman did. Her name was Donna Myers, who was a fence who purchased them off of a man who called himself Rick. And Donna gave the police the names of the people she gave the jewelry to, and the people started telling the police that they were acquainted with a man named Rick from El Paso. However, he's hard to locate because he moves around all the time and lives in hotels. And through speaking with Donna, they were able to find another man who came in contact with Rick, who provided them with the same identification. So Donna Meyer said that she lived with a friend named Armando Rodriguez in El Paso in 1979 and met Rick through him. Armando had moved to California, and Donna remembers Rick staying at the house multiple times. And Armando told the police that he didn't know Rick that well, but he did know that his last name was Ramirez. Rewind that and drink every time I say Rick. The stories when it's someone says something are very difficult to track down and then say it on the show. It's very difficult for me to do. That one was fun though. It was kind of like a little tour de France there. So with all this information that the detectives got from Donna Meyer and Armando Rodriguez, they start running every search on their database for a crime committed by Rick Ricardo or Richard Ramirez in the system. Richard was running high on pure excitement, and at the same time, heightened paranoia. He contemplated killing his fence because he didn't trust him anymore. He knew too much. Still craving his need for murderous sex, he stole an orange Toyota and went cruising around the home of a 13-year-old boy named James Romero III, who was working on his scooter in the front garage. He was busy working when he heard the sound of footsteps in the gravel outside of his house. James heard the noise and shot up and ran towards the sound. Outside of his parents' window, he seen a tall man in blue jeans and a black jacket wearing a baseball cap, trying to break in through the house. Richard seen the boy and the two stared at each other. Then, Richard took off running. James bravely chased after the man and seen the orange Toyota and took the license plate number 482RTS. Richard parked away from the house that he decided to break into, located on Crescenta Drive in Orange County, California. The home belonged to 29-year-old Bill Carnes and his 27-year-old fiance, Inez Erickson. At first, the stalker attempted to open the front door and the windows, but none were easy to open. Moving along the back of the house, he was able to pry open a window and remove the screen. Silently, he moved along the walls, carrying nothing but his .25 automatic and a penlight. Earlier that evening, Bill and his fiance had been discussing the Night Stalker murders, so they became light sleepers due to fear. When Richard entered their home, he aimed the gun at Bill's sleeping form. The sound of the gun cocking caused Bill to shoot out of bed and run for a weapon, but the attacker was too fast. He shot Bill in the head, and Richard took two more shots at the man's skull, causing him to fall back hard. Richard noticed movement under the covers of the bed and ripped them away.
Wake up, bitch! And you don't scream or I'll kill you. You don't make a fucking sound, understand?
Revealing the terrified Inez Erickson. He asked her if she knew who he was. She told him no.
I am a soldier of Satan. There's nothing you can do to stop me. You stupid fucking bitch! Don't you fucking move.
When Richard proudly announced that he was the Night Stalker, Inez cried out. Inflaming his ego, Richard screamed at her to worship Satan, not to God.
Swear to Satan, bitch!
He threw her off the bed and hogtied her limbs behind her body. Inez told him where to find $400 that she had stashed away. Richard took the money. He then kissed her, somewhat passionately, and said, "You know this is what saved you. This is all your life is worth. And tell them that the Night Stalker was here." Both Bill and Inez survived. Inez was able to give the most accurate description of her attacker. And the 13-year-old boy, James Romero III, told police that he had seen the attacker in the orange Toyota, and that he had the license plate number. This was a huge break in the case, and they knew somewhere the killer would dump the vehicle. It was only a matter of time. Days after the last attack, the orange Toyota was discovered abandoned and taken to the yard. The officers took James Romero III to a yard filled with impounded vehicles. In driving through, James immediately identified the orange Toyota. The police then dusted the car for fingerprints and lifted fingerprints off of the mirror and searched. They got a hit. They belonged to a 25-year-old drifter out of El Paso, Texas, named Richard Leyva Munoz Ramirez. The LAPD finally had a name and a face for their suspect. Sheriff Block released a statement saying, quote, "We know who you are now, and soon everyone else will. There is no place for you to hide." The entire city of Los Angeles was now on a manhunt for the Night Stalker. On August 30th, 1985, Richard decided he wanted to visit his brother Robert in Tucson, Arizona. He got onto a Greyhound bus, completely unaware that he had been identified as the Night Stalker. When he arrived, he was only there for a short time. Richard had gotten into a fight with Robert over the possibility of Richard flirting with his wife Samantha. The fight caused Richard to cut his visit short and head back to Los Angeles. At 7:25 a.m., Richard awoke at the bus station back in Los Angeles. He walked down the street in the blazing heat and decided to go into Mike's liquor store to get a coffee and a pastry. He failed to notice people staring at him as he entered. As he was paying at the till, he noticed an elderly woman staring at him and pointing at him from the back of the store. "El matador, matador," which translates to the killer. Confused, Richard looked around. His eyes then fell upon the cover of the Los Angeles newspaper with the mugshot and his full name staring back at him. Night Stalker suspect identified. 25-year-old LA man. named in 7 months' spree of killings. This can't be happening, he thought. He grabbed a copy of the paper and ran out of the store. The store owner had called the police, and soon the cruisers and alarms were running down the street. Richard turned quick and ran into a yard and jumped a 6-foot fence to get away. Running in and out of backyards, he started heading towards the Santa Ana freeway with helicopters and police on his tail. Flying across the freeway, he had to make it to East LA to catch a bus. As he got there, the bus was about to leave. He quickly jumped on and paid his fare. Sitting down, he began catching his breath. One thing Richard was good at was running. He'd been doing it his entire life. It didn't take long for his heavy breathing to capture the attention of the citizens on the bus. They started yelling at him, and the bus came to a stop. Darting off, Richard began fleeing again. He needed a car, something fast and quick. He had already devised a plan to jump the border, bleach his hair, get glasses, and change his name. Running down the streets, people started calling the police and recognizing him. 3 teenage Mexican boys began hunting him down, but Richard turned to them with a gun and yelled, "Get the fuck away from me." As he continued running, he seen Manuela Villanueva sitting in her car alone. He approached the driver's door and cried, "My mother is dying, I need your car." The frightened woman yelled that he couldn't have it. Richard began pulling her out of the car as her boyfriend, a large man named Carmelo Robles, joined by another man named Arthur Benavides, ran to help her. The two men had a moment of shock when their eyes met those of the dreaded Night Stalker. Recognizing who he was, they stumbled, and Richard took off, but that only ignited the fire in the men. Joined by another man named Frank Moreno, the three men chased Richard. Richard ran for blocks, being chased by multiple citizens. As he hopped fences, he seen a red Mustang. It was being worked on by a man named Faustino Pinon in his driveway. He tried to steal the vehicle, but was ripped out of the driver's seat by Faustino. The car went into a chimney. Snaking his way out of his grip, Richard started running again, looking for any vehicle that he could find. At this point, multiple people had been yelling "El Matador" as they chased Richard Ramirez down the street. Richard was turning around and sticking his tongue out and hissing at the men chasing him. Then finally, a man named Manuel de Tor swung a metal pipe and hit Richard on the top of the head, causing him to fall onto the pavement. The mob reached him and relentlessly beat him, and Richard could only attempt to shield himself as Manuel stood over top of him, ready to swing at any moment. The police arrived at Hubbard Street close to 8 a.m. to find a crowd of several hundred people circling a lone man. Sheriff's deputy Andre Ramirez, with no relation, had arrived from Downey Road only 4 blocks away. He asked who the man on the ground was, and he was told by the crowd, "The Night Stalker. We caught Richard Ramirez." While in custody, Richard told the police, quote,
"I want the electric chair. They should have shot me on the street. Let me have a gun to play Russian roulette. I'd rather die than just spend the rest of my life in prison."
This is where the story gets even more bananas. So I listened to over 5 hours of the detailing of the state of California versus Richard Ramirez trial. I'll attempt to sum it up here in layman's terms as best as I can. So, Richard is caught, and he admits to the police that he's the Night Stalker, but then he starts demanding a lawyer. And Richard wanted to plead guilty to all of the charges because he felt that he was going to get the death penalty no matter what, because the media already told the world that he was the Night Stalker before he was even captured or convicted. And Richard told his family that he was innocent and that he had nothing to do with the murders, and they believed him. And groupies all over the world saw this mugshot and believed he was innocent. And I found this very interesting. When Richard was arrested at first, he was always hiding his face and ducking away from the media. And then he continued to comment on how no one liked him and everyone wanted him dead, so he just wanted to plead guilty. Then, during jury selection in 1988, Richard noticed a lot of women in the courtroom. And once he was taken out of the court, he noticed a lot more people were supporting him on the streets because they thought he was either sexy, innocent, or the protector of darkness, and they wanted him to be free. And Anton LaVey's daughter actually traveled to California to see him in court. So before he seen all these people, he thought that everyone on this planet, every single person, wanted him dead, and he was guilty no matter what he tried to do, even though he was guilty. So he was terrified and he wanted to be shot right there. He didn't want to have to go through a trial of people convicting him. But then Richard did a complete 180 when he seen all of these people who were supporting him. He realized that not everyone hated him for what he did. He realized that there were people who were fanning over him even after they realized what he did. And that's when you see his demeanor change completely. He has this obnoxious, in-your-face, Satan's rock star persona. And the sunglasses, those didn't become a thing until Richard started getting yelled at during jury selection because he was falling asleep in court. And then one of his groupies named Doreen bought them for him. So Richard fights to get this fucking lawyer named Daniel Hernandez, who I don't know how many times cheesed me off during that trial because he just kept prolonging everything due to his lack of experience. And it got so bad that even Richard at one point was like, "You need to keep this going because I'm sick of this." Like, Richard got annoyed. And Richard did the famous hand up with the pentagram on it during jury selection, and he yelled, "Hail Satan." And he was telling his mother that he was innocent. And his mother was so mad because she's like, "Richard, if you want a fair trial to fight the death penalty, you have to behave." And during the trial, Richard ended up getting in trouble a lot because he was laughing at the witnesses, he was intimidating the witnesses, and it just never ended. The whole trial was crazy. I highly recommend reading the transcripts of it. So this is disturbing. During the trial, Richard was locked up in a 6x8 cell where he couldn't do anything. And he had the crime scene photographs of his victims on the walls, which was legal because it was his case. Actor Sean Penn was serving a short sentence of a couple weeks for assaulting paparazzi in the county jail, and his cell was located next to Richard's. And Sean Penn said that Richard Ramirez, quote, "masturbated excessively like an animal in heat." So Sean confirmed that the sexual activity was fueled by the photographs that he had of his victims on the wall of his cell. Richard lacked complete empathy for others and had an absence of guilt about his actions. So we're going to skip ahead to August 15th, 1988. One of the jurors, her name was Phyllis Singletary, she didn't show up for court one day, and the police found that she had been murdered. And this caused an uproar because everyone thought that Richard was involved. He did at one point try to scare people by saying he was going to have a groupie bring a gun to court for him and he was going to shoot up the courtroom. The police made sure this didn't happen. So now everyone is in this uproar and Richard's mad because, one, he actually had nothing to do with it, and two, now the trial is probably going to take longer because the jury is terrified and there might be a mistrial and he'd have to do it all over again. Richard just wants this all fucking over with. The police discovered that Phyllis was murdered by her husband, who later committed suicide, and he left a note. Now the irony is what gets me here. Richard is like, "I had nothing to do with this." And the note explained how Phyllis and her husband got into a fight because she started feeling sympathy for Richard in court because he was labeled guilty before being convicted. And her husband was like, "What the fuck is wrong with you?" And he got so mad that she felt this way that he killed her, and then he killed himself after. So even though Richard wasn't involved, he like was involved. Legally, he wasn't involved, but mentally, he was there. He was front row stage. The entire trial cost the state of California $1.8 million, or in 2021 currency, $3.93 million, which surpasses the O.J. Simpson trial. And on September 20th, 1989, 29-year-old Richard Ramirez was found guilty on 13 counts of murder, 5 counts of attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, and 14 burglaries. And he was sentenced to death via gas chamber. But we're not done. In 1989, Richard's father, Julian, told the El Paso Times that he was in shock that his son had committed such horrendous atrocities, saying, quote, "I don't know if he did it or not, but if he did, he didn't do it by himself. Why didn't the police investigate to see who else was involved? I've accepted that he was a thief, but I never accepted that he did the things that they say he did. If he is guilty, I'm not opposed to him being punished, but they should prove these things with the sincere truth." Richard's father blamed the media for turning his son into a monster, saying, quote, "He is really just a poor boy raised to believe in God." He blamed his son's drug use for the antisocial personality disorder. After Richard's sentencing, he was sent to San Quentin State Prison's death row. The California Supreme Court denied his first rounds of appeals on August 7, 2006. Then he was denied for another hearing a month later. While in prison, Richard received thousands of letters from groupies who were still madly in love with him. Some letters were from fellow Satanists who believed that he did the right thing in the name of Lucifer. The letters Richard received usually discussed the same topics: food, family, and music. Richard himself never discussed any of his crimes or trials in the messages. He would ask for full-body pictures of women in little clothing, and he received hundreds of photos, and even pictures of women's feet, because they all knew that he had a fetish for them. Abristophilia. We are going there, fear cult. Let's discuss the disgusting phenomenon of people who are sexually attracted to serial killers. The term abristophilia is also known as Bonnie and Clyde syndrome, and serial killers have the ultimate bad boy appeal that certain people want. From Richard Ramirez to Ted Bundy. Those of you who are new to the show, I hate Ted Bundy. Moving on. In the psychology article written by Catherine Ramonson, titled "Women Who Love Serial Killers," she makes fascinating points. The idea of a taboo, dangerous relationship that can't be consummated just appeals to insecure women who cannot maintain regular romantic relationships. And it's believed that these women feel a protection from a hyper-aggressive male who they want to nurture, in hopes that they can change him or make him a better person. Also, if a serial killer is in prison, the woman just assumes that the man is thinking about her 24/7, because what else is he gonna do? Richard, however, was writing multiple women while in prison, so these ladies were not his only cup of tea. Even after all of the evidence being shown in court, the testimonies, the victims crying, the arrogance from Ramirez, he still had all these women lining up to see him in court. And Richard, he loved it. And retired homicide detective Gil Carrillo explained in an interview that as soon as Richard would walk into the courtroom, he would immediately search for an attractive woman in the audience. And then once he found one, the whole day he would just glance, smile, and wink at her throughout the day. It was his entertainment. And Carrillo recalls in an interview with KRON4 that there was this one day he was in court and they were adjourned for recess. Richard Ramirez struts out of the courtroom and two female attorneys were dressed up sitting in the front aisles. And when Richard was walking by, he noticed them and they returned smiles. And the one female attorney, she smiled back at him, opened up her legs, and blew him a kiss. Oh my God. And it's funny when Carrillo explains this story, because his response was, "Holy Jesus." That man, oh, he is a gem. I adore his interviews. I watch so many of them. I can't get enough of him. He's golden. And the one juror, Cynthia Haddon, she actually got dismissed from jury duty because she admitted publicly that she was falling in love with Richard Ramirez during the ongoing trial. On Valentine's Day, this woman sends him a fucking cupcake with a message saying, "I love you" on it. You have the balls, woman. And after Ramirez got convicted and guilty of murder, Cynthia started visiting him in prison. She introduced him to her parents, and she ended up helping Richard with his appeals. Ugh. Sometimes, as much as I try to understand people, they confuse me more. While incarcerated on death row, Richard was asked about his feelings towards these women who were drawn to serial killers. And Richard responded with saying, quote, "They want to get something out of me, to question me. Maybe they're intrigued by murder or murderers. Some are religious. Some are just sympathetic, you know. They have sympathy for me. Some come just so they can tell their friends they came and talked to me." Doreen Leoy was a successful 41-year-old magazine editor from Burbank, California. She worked for Tiger Beat magazine in the 70s and 80s, and it was during this time that she met and helped many upcoming celebrities. For example, the actor John Stamos, who played Uncle Jesse in Full House, Doreen had groomed him to become the star that he is today, and he even credited her with aiding him in the world of fame. John Stamos remembered Doreen recalling her as, quote, very lonely woman. To be that lonely, that is the only man on this planet that she could find? I just thought, how horrible. This man is the personification of evil, just a monster. While Richard was on trial, Doreen had seen him on television and thought that he was absolutely captivating. Looking back, she said it was a turning point for her. She seen his mugshot in the middle of the show Dallas, and she saw something in his eyes. She didn't know anything about him, but she wanted him. She assumed it was the vulnerability. Doreen had begun writing Richard letters soon after the arrest. The two agreed to meet a year later. It was during this time when Richard was doing the interviews with Philip Carlo, author of the biography The Night Stalker. Philip explained that he noticed something that set Doreen apart from the countless women who fell in love with Richard, saying, quote, this is a man who had many women visiting him and writing him passionate letters, including a woman who served on the jury who admitted she had fallen in love with him, even as she voted him to the death sentence. But Doreen was different. He trusts her completely and she trusts him. Everything in her life is about Richard. He is her sunrise and her sunset. She sees the same little boy when she looks at Richard that his mother does, a wonderful little boy who loved to dance to the music on the radio. Doreen and Richard got engaged in July of 1988. When Richard had asked for her hand in marriage, Doreen accepted. Although they were very aware that serial killers do not get conjugal visits, the couple were happy with the occasional small embraces surrounded by officers. The first time they met face to face, Doreen recalled that she fell into his arms and was madly in love. She had believed that he was innocent of his crimes and that he was too sweet of a person to have committed such acts, even when Richard said he was guilty. After he was arrested, Richard said, quote, I love to kill people. I love to watch them die. I would shoot them in the head and they would squirm all over the place and then just stop. Or I would cut them with a knife and watch their faces turn white. I love all that blood. Doreen seemed to brush everything off. On October 3rd, 1996, Doreen Leoy became Mrs. Richard Ramirez on death row. Richard's mother, Mercedes, refused to attend the wedding. Richard's brother, Reuben, and his sister, Ruth, attended. Absolutely no one from Doreen's family or friends supported the decision. And after 11 years of communicating through letters, prison visits, the couple were finally together. Doreen stated that she would commit suicide when her husband was finally executed. Her love seemed to be truly never-ending for Richard Ramirez. Until 2009, when DNA testing matched Richard's DNA with the evidence of the rape and murder of 9-year-old Mei Ling in 1984. Doreen could not forgive the embarrassment she had felt for being so blind and separated from Richard in 2009, never speaking to him again, and to this day has stayed out of the public. Prior to Richard's death, he was engaged again to an author named Christine Lee, but that clearly meant nothing to Richard, because Richard didn't want to see her when he was dying in the hospital. He wanted to see no one and died alone. On June 3rd, 2013, 53-year-old Richard Ramirez died of B-cell lymphoma, a form of blood cancer. He had also been affected by all the years of substance abuse and hepatitis C. According to A&E, prisoners tend to age faster. This is due to previous poor health choices, like addiction, paranoia, and stress, that can cause them to become more susceptible to illnesses and chronic conditions. Recent studies estimate that by 2030, 1 in 3 incarcerated prisoners over the age of 55 will be diagnosed with kidney and liver disease, cancer, and/or heart disease. The family of Richard Ramirez issued a statement after the death, acknowledging the mourning of their son and brother, no matter how the world judged him, because it no longer mattered. They asked the world to respect their sorrow and grief. No one claimed Richard's body, and he refused to see visitors during the last 3 years of his life. When Richard was sentenced to death, he said, quote,
big deal. Death always went with the territory.
That is the full true story of Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that you have a better understanding of that psycho. And just so you know, all the advertisements on my friggin' computer are all dental related, so thank you very much. I can't get over that someone wanted to marry him. Like, how lacklustered was that wedding? Actually, though, the only important wedding that came out of that entire case was that of Detective Frank Salerno's son, Mike, and the survivor, Whitney Bennett. They got married, and they met at a party, they exchanged numbers, and then they started dating and got married. Isn't that cute? I think that brings a smile to everyone's faces. That's happy. And huge shout out to the cameos in this episode. Miguel and Jesse were played by Steve and Megan from the For the Booze podcast. And I loved listening to you guys argue in the rough drafts. There was a snippet at the end where Megan says the line, "You know what? Go ahead, shoot me. Just shoot me." And then all you hear is Steve go, "Boom, you're dead." It was so funny. Actually, I'm going to play it. Here it is.
"We both know you won't do that because then you'd have to get a job. Actually, you know what? Shoot me. I dare you. Fucking shoot me."
"You're dead."
Boom.
And the audio Oscar for Outstanding Portrayal of a Serial Killer goes to Jericho from the Ask the Fellas podcast, who portrayed Richard Ramirez better than Richard Ramirez. And I mean that with the best intent. I felt like Jericho had a lot of pressure riding on him because he knows that this case is the serial killer case that has fascinated me for decades. And as you all heard, he absolutely crushed it. So thank you very much. You killed it. While I was recording my responses to his dramatizations, I was doing it late at night, and I didn't realize until after that my windows were open. So me screaming and yelling all that stuff and that dramatization, the entire neighborhood heard. What can I say? Go hard or go home. Like, you gotta commit to the art, right? Shaka McCalla.
"There'll be more, many more. They're coming for me now. And then they'll come for you."
On our never-ending quest to find a truly scary movie, I am recommending the 2016 found footage franchise, The Blackwell Ghost. And it was recommended to me by Fear Cult ambassadors, Megan and Steve, from the For the Booze podcast, because I told them that I was watching this movie called Dibbit Box, a Chris Chambers story, which is also a found footage film, where this man orders a cursed box online and shit just goes down. And if you follow Lullaby on Instagram, then you'll recall me posting when Chris Chambers opens the box and then the EMF reader just goes, like, it just stops because he lets the friggin' demon out. And the movie was so good, and then that ending just let me down so bad that I had to complain to someone. And I was like, "Steve, come on." And then he and his wife Megan said, "Oh, we got a film for you, The Blackwell Ghost." So good. The movie follows a filmmaker who wants to prove that ghosts are not real, but he soon realizes that he put himself into a scenario that will affect him forever. There are a total of 6 films in the series, and the 6th one came out this year, and I'm currently on the 4th one. They're so well done, you kind of got to binge it. They have wicked backstories, and the filmmaker is very entertaining. So, I tried to scare you, now you try to scare me. You can reach out and send me your horror movie recommendations at lullabythefearpodcast.com or on Twitter, on Instagram, or Facebook. And I'm about to watch a film recommendation called Raw from a cult ambassador named Brown Eyes. That's what you're going by, chica. So, thank you. And don't forget to rate and share the podcast to support the show. So thank you for listening to this week's lullaby. Sweet dreams. Lights out.